mind, I can no longer move. The magic that ensnares Elias has gripped Darin and me, too.
Nightbringer, Shaver whispers. Forgive my wrong. I was young.
Her voice fades to a choke. The Nightbringer, silent, brushes his fingers across Shaver's forehead like a father giving his benediction. Then he stabs her through the heart. Shaver's body seizes once, her arms windmilling, her body jerking up, as if yearning toward the blade, and her mouth opens. I expect a shriek, a scream. Instead, words pour out.
One piece remains, and beware the reaper at the gates. The sparrows will drown, and none will know it. The past shall burn, and none will slow it. The dead will rise, and none can survive. The child will be bathed in blood, but alive. The pearl will crack, the cold will enter. The butcher will break, and none will hold her. The ghost will fall, her flesh will wither. By the grain moon, the king will have his answer. By the grain moon, the forgotten will find their master.
Shaver's chin falls. Her lashes flutter like a butterfly's wings, and the blade embedded in her chest drips blood that is as red as mine. Her face goes slack, and her body bursts into flame, a flash of blinding fire that fizzles into ashes after only seconds.
No!
Elias shouts, two streaks of wet on either side of his face.
Do not make the Nightbringer angry, Elias! I want to scream. Do not get yourself killed!
A cloud of cinders swirls about the Nightbringer, all that is left of Shaver. He looks up for the first time at Elias, cocks his head and advances, dripping sickle in hand. Distantly, I remember Elias telling me what he learned from the Soul Catcher, that the star protects those who have touched it. The Nightbringer cannot kill Elias, but he can hurt him, and by the skies I will not have anyone else I care about hurt. I hurl myself forward and bounce back. The Nightbringer ignores me, comfortable in his power.
You will not hurt, Elias. You will not.
Some feral darkness rises within me and takes control of my body. I felt it once before, months ago, when I fought the Nightbringer outside Koff Prison. An animal cry explodes from my lips. This time, when I push ahead, I get through. Darin is a half-step behind, and the Nightbringer flicks his wrist. My brother freezes, but the djinn's magic has no effect on me. I leap between the Nightbringer and Elias, dagger out.
Don't you dare touch him, I say.
The Nightbringer's sun eyes flare as he looks first at me, then at Elias, reading what is between us. I think of how he betrayed me.
Monster!
How close is he to setting the djinn free? Shaver's prophecy answered the question moments ago. One piece of the star left. Does the Nightbringer know where it is? What does Shaver's death gain him? But as he observes me, I remember the love that roiled within him, and the hate as well. I remember the vicious war waged between the two, and the desolation left in their wake. The Nightbringer's shoulder ripples as if he is unsettled. Can he read my thoughts? He shifts his attention over my shoulder to Elias.
Elias Veturius.
The djinn leans over me, and I cringe back, pressing against Elias's chest, caught between the two of them, my friend's pounding heart and despair at Shaver's death and the Nightbringer's eldritch wrath, fueled by a millennium of cruelty and suffering. The djinn doesn't bother looking at me before he speaks.
She tasted sweet, boy, he says. Like dew, and a clear dawn.
Behind me, Elias stills, and takes a steadying breath. He meets the Nightbringer's fiery stare, his face paling in shock at what he sees there. Then he growls, a sound that seems to rise out of the very earth. Shadows twist up like vines of ink beneath his skin. Every muscle in his shoulders, his chest, his arms strains until he is tearing free of his invisible bonds. He raises his hands, a shockwave bursting from his skin, knocking me on my back. The Nightbringer sways before righting himself.
Ah, he observes. The pup has a bite. All the better.
I cannot see his face within that hood, but I hear the smile in his voice. He rises up as wind floods the clearing.
There is no joy in destroying a weak foe.
He turns his attention east, towards something far out of sight. Whispers hiss on the air as if he's communicating with someone. Then the wind snatches at him and, as in the forest outside, cough. He disappears. But this time, instead of silence to mark his passing, the ghosts who fled to the borders of the waiting place pour into the clearing, swarming me.
You liar, this is because of you. Shaeva is dead. Elias is condemned. The djinn, a breath from victory.
Because of me. There are so many. The truth of their words breaks over me like a net of chains. I try to stand against it, but I cannot, for the spirits do not lie. One piece remains. The Nightbringer must find only one more piece of the star before he is able to free his kin. He is close now, close enough that I can no longer deny it, close enough that I must act. The ghosts tornado around me, so angry I fear they will tear off my skin. But Elias cuts through them and lifts me to my feet. Darin is beside me, grabbing my pack from where it has fallen, glaring at the ghosts as they ease back into the trees, barely restrained. Before I even say the words, my brother nods. He heard what Shaeva said. He knows what we must do. We're going to Edessa. I say it anyway. To stop him. To finish this.
Chapter 9. Elias. The full burden of the waiting place descends like a boulder dropping onto my back. The forest is part of me, and I can feel the borders, the ghosts, the trees. It's as if a living map of the place has been imprinted on my mind. Shaeva's absence is at the heart of that burden. I gaze at the fallen basket of herbs that she'll never add to the korma, that she'll never eat, in the house she'll never step foot in again. Elias! The ghosts! Lyra draws close. The usually mournful spirits have transformed into violent shades. I need M'Arthur's magic to silence them. I need to bond with him, the way Shaeva wanted me to. But when I grasp at M'Arthur with my will, I feel only a trace of the magic before it fades. Elias? Despite the shrieking ghosts, Lyra takes my hand, her lips drawn down in concern. I'm so sorry about Shaeva. Is she really... I nod. She's gone. It was so fast. Somehow I am comforted by the fact that someone is as stunned as I am. Are you... Will you be... She shakes her head. Of course you're not all right. Skies, how could you be? A groan from Darin pulls our attention away from each other. The ghosts circle him, darting close and whispering Skies know what. Bleeding hells. I need to get Lyra and Darin out of here. If you want to get to Edessa, I say, the fastest way is through the forest. You'll lose months going around. Right. Lyra pauses and furrows her brow. But, Elias, if we speak more of Shaver, I think something inside me will break. She was here, and now she's gone, and nothing can change that. The permanence of death will always feel like a betrayal. But raging against it when my friends are in danger is the act of a fool. I must move. I must make sure Shaver didn't die for nothing. Lyra is still speaking when I take Darin's hand and begin to windwalk. She goes quiet as the forest fades past us. She squeezes my hand, and I know that she understands my silence. I cannot travel with Shaver's swiftness, but we reach one of the bridges over the river Dusk after only a quarter hour, and seconds later, we're beyond it. I angle northeast, and as we move through the trees, Lyra peeks at me from beneath the wing of hair that has fallen over her eye. I want to speak to her. Damn the Nightbringer, I want to say. I don't care what he said. I only care that you are all right. We'll be there soon, I begin, before another voice speaks, a hateful chorus that is instantly recognizable.
You will fail, usurper.
The djinn, but their grove is miles away. How are they projecting their voices this far?
Filth, your world will fall. Our king has already thwarted you. This is just the beginning.
Piss off, I snarl. I think of the whispers I heard just before the Nightbringer disappeared. He was giving these fiery monsters orders, no doubt. The djinn laugh.
Our kind are powerful, mortal. You cannot replace a djinn. You cannot hope to succeed as soul catcher.
I ignore them, hoping they'll shut the hells up. Did they ever do this to Shaver? Were they always bellowing in her head, and she just never told me? My chest aches when I think of the soul catcher. And of so many others. Tristus, Demetrius, Leander, the Bloodshrike, my grandfather. Are all those who get close to me fated to suffer? Darin shivers, gritting his teeth against the onslaught of the ghosts. Lyra's skin is grey, though she walks on without a word of complaint.
In the end, they will fade. You will endure. Love cannot live here.
Lyra's hand is cool and small in mine. Her pulse flutters against my fingers, a tenuous reminder of her mortality. Even if she survives to be an old woman, her years are nothing against the life of a soul catcher. She will die and I will abide, becoming less and less human as time passes.
There!
Lyra points ahead. The trees thin, and through them I spot the cottage where Darin recovered from his injuries at Koth, months ago now. When we reach the tree line, I release the siblings. Darin grabs me and pulls me into a rough hug.
I don't know how to thank you,
he begins, but I stop him. Stay alive, I say. That'll be thanks enough. I'll have enough problems here without your ghost showing up. Darin offers a flash of a smile before glancing at his sister and prudently heading for the cottage. Lyra twists her hands together, not looking at me. Her hair has come free from its braid as it always does, in fat, unruly curls. I reach for one, unable to help myself.
I have something for you.
I rummage around in a pocket and pull out a piece of wood. It is unfinished. The carvings on it rough. You reach for your old armlet sometimes. I feel ridiculous all of a sudden. Why would I give her this hideous thing? It looks like a 6-year-old made it.
It's not finished, but, I thought...
It's perfect.
Her fingers brush mine as she takes it. That touch. 10 hells. I steady my breath and crush the desire that thrums in my veins. She slides the armlet on, and seeing her in that familiar pose, one hand resting on the cuff, it feels right.
Thank you.
Watch your back in Edessa. I turn to practicalities. They are easier to speak of than this feeling in my chest, like my heart is being carved out of me and lit on fire. The mariners will know your face, and if they know what Darin can do... I catch her smile and realize that, like a fool, I'm telling her things she already knows.
I thought we would have more time, she says. I thought we'd find a way out for you, that Shaver would release you from your vow, or...
She looks like I feel, broken. I need to let her go. Fight the Nightbringer, I should say. Win, find joy, remember me. But why should she come back here? Her future is in the world of the living.
Say it, Elias, my logic screams. Make it easier for both of you. Don't be pathetic.
Liar, you should... I don't want to let you go. Not yet.
She traces my jaw with a light hand, her fingers lingering on my mouth. She wants me. I can see it, feel it, and it makes me desire her even more desperately.
Not so soon.
Neither do I. I pull her into my arms, reveling in the warmth of her body against mine, the curve of her hip beneath my hand. She tucks her head beneath my chin, and I breathe her in. Martha tugs at me, harsh and sudden. Against my will, I sway back toward the forest. No, no! Ghosts be damned. Martha be damned. Waiting place be damned. I grab her hand and pull her toward me, and as if she was waiting for it, she closes her eyes and rises up on her toes. Her hands tangle in my hair, drawing me tightly toward her. Her lips are soft and lush, and when she presses every curve into me, I nearly lose my feet. I hear nothing but Lyra, see nothing but Lyra, feel nothing but Lyra. My mind races forward to me laying her down on the forest floor, spending hours exploring every inch of her body. For a moment, I see what we could have had. Lyra and her books and patience, and me and a school that taught more than death and duty. A little one with gold eyes and glowing brown skin. The white in Lyra's hair one day, and the way her eyes will mellow and deepen and grow wiser.
You are cruel, Elias, she whispers against my mouth. To give a girl all she desires, only to tear it away.
This isn't the end for us, Lyra of Sarah. I cannot give up what we could have. I don't care what bleeding vow I made. Do you hear me? This is not our end.
You've never been a Lyra.
She dashes her hands against the wetness in her eyes.
Don't start now.
Her back is straight as she walks away, and when she reaches the cottage, Darin, waiting outside, rises. She goes past him quickly, and he follows. I watch her until she is just a shadow on the horizon.
Turn around, I think. Just once. Turn around.
She doesn't. And perhaps it's just as well.
Chapter 10 The Bloodshrike. I spend the rest of the day in the Black Guard barracks, reading through spy reports. Most are mundane. A prisoner transfer that could guarantee the loyalty of a Mercator house. An investigation into the death of two illustrian paters. I pay closest attention to the reports out of Tiberim. With the approach of spring, the Karkin clans are expected to come pouring out of the mountains, raiding and reaving. But my spies say the Karkins are quiet. Perhaps their leader, this Grimar, committed too many forces to the attack on Navium. Perhaps Tiberium is uncommonly lucky. Or perhaps those blue-faced bastards are up to something. I request reports from all the northern garrisons. By the time the midnight bells ring, I am exhausted, and my desk is only half clear. But I stop anyway, foregoing a meal despite the rumbling in my belly, and pulling on my boots and a cloak. Sleep will not come, not when the crack of Livia's bones still rings through my head. Not when I'm wondering what ambush the Commandant will have waiting for me in Navium. The hallway outside my quarters is silent and dark. Most of the Blackguard should be asleep, but there's always at least a half dozen men on watch. I don't want to be followed. I suspect the Commandant has spies among my men. I head for the armory, where a hidden passage leads into the heart of the city. Shrike. The whisper is soft, but I jump anyway, cursing at the sight of the green eyes shining like a cat's from across the hall. Avitas, I hiss, why are you lurking out here?
Don't take the armory tunnel, he says. Peter Cecilius has a man watching the route. I'll have him taken care of, but there wasn't time tonight.
Are you spying on me?
You're predictable, Shrike. Any time Marcus hurts her, you take a walk. Captain Dex reminded me that it's against regulations for the Shrike to be unaccompanied. So here I am.
I know Harper is simply carrying out his duties. I have been irresponsible, wandering the city at night without any guards. Still, I'm vexed. Harper serenely ignores my discontent and nods to the laundry closet. There must be another passageway there. Once we're inside the narrow space, my armor clanks against his, and I grimace, hoping no one hears us. Skies know what they would say at finding us pressed together in a dark closet. My face heats thinking of it. Thank the skies for my mask.
Where's the bleeding entrance?
It's just... He reaches around me and up, rummaging through uniforms. I lean back, catching a V-shaped glimpse of the smooth brown skin at his throat. His scent is light, barely there, but warm, like cinnamon and cedar. I take a deeper sniff, glancing up at him as I do, to find him staring at me, eyebrows raised. You smell not unpleasant, I say stiffly. I was simply noticing.
Of course, Shrike.
His mouth quirks a little. Is that a bleeding smile?
Shall we?
As if sensing my annoyance, Harper pushes open a section of the closet behind me and moves through quickly. We do not speak again as we wend our way through the secret passageways of the Black Guard barracks and out into the chill spring night. Harper drops back when we are above ground, and I soon forget he is near. Hood pulled low, I ghost through Antium's lower level, through the crowded scholars' sector, past inns and bustling taprooms, barracks and plebeian-heavy neighbourhoods. The guards at the upper gate do not see me as I pass into the city's second tier, a trick I play to keep my edge. I find myself toying with my father's ring as I walk, the ring of Jen's Aquila. Sometimes, when I look at it, I still see the blood that coated it, the blood that spattered my face and armor when Marcus cut Father's throat. Don't think about that. I spin it round, trying to take comfort from its presence. Give me the wisdom of all the Aquilas, I find myself thinking. Help me defeat my foe. I soon reach my destination, a wooded park outside the Hall of Records. At this hour, I expected the hall to be dark, but a dozen lamps are lit, and the archivists are still hard at work. The long pillared building is spectacular for its size and simplicity, but I take comfort from it because of what is within. Records of lineages, births, deaths, dispatches, treaties, trade agreements, and laws. If the Emperor is the heart of the Empire, and the people are its lifeblood, then the Hall of Records is its memory. No matter how hopeless I feel, coming here reminds me of all the marshals have built in the 500 years since the Empire was founded.
All empires fall, Bloodshrike.
When Cain steps from the shadows, I reach for my blade. I have thought many times about what I would do if I saw the Augur again. Always, I saw myself remaining calm. Silent. I would hold myself aloof from him. I would give him nothing of my mind. My intentions vanish at the sight of his accursed face. The passion with which I want to break his frail neck astounds me. I didn't know I could have this much hate in me. Hannah's pleading fills my ears. Helly, I'm sorry. And my mother's calm words as she knelt for her death. Strength, my girl. My father's ring cuts into my palm. But as I draw the blade, my arm freezes and drops, forced to my side by the Augur. The lack of control is enraging and unsettling.
Such anger, he murmurs.
You destroyed my life. You could have saved them. You monster.
What of you, Bloodshrike? Are you not a monster?
Cain's hood is low, but I can still make out the inquisitive gleam of his gaze. You're different, I spit. You're like them, the Commandant, or Marcus, or the Nightbringer.
Ah, but the Nightbringer is no monster, child, though he may do monstrous things. He is cloven by sorrow, and thus locked in a righteous battle to amend a grievous wrong. Much like you, I think you are more similar than you know. You could learn much from the Nightbringer, if he deigned to teach you.
I don't bleeding want anything to do with any of you, I hiss. You are a monster, even if you...
But you are a paragon of perfection?
Cain tilts his head, appearing genuinely curious.
You live and breathe and eat and sleep on the backs of those less fortunate. Your entire existence is due to the oppression of those you view to be lesser. But why you, Bloodshrike? Why did fate see fit to make you the oppressor instead of the oppressed? What is the meaning of your life?
The Empire. I shouldn't answer. I should ignore him. But a lifetime of reverence dies hard. That is the meaning of my life.
Perhaps,
Cain shrugs, a strangely human gesture.
I did not, in truth, come here to argue philosophy with you. I came with a message.
He pulls an envelope from his robes. At the sight of the seal, a bird winging over a shining city, I snatch it from him. Livia. As I open it, I keep one eye on the Augur. Come to me, sister. I need you. Yours always, Livia. When did she send this? I scan the message quickly. And why did she send it with you? She could have...
She asked, and I acquiesced. Anyone else would have been followed, and that would not have aligned with my interests, or hers.
Cain touches my masked brow gently.
Fare thee well, Bloodshrike. I will see you once more, before your end.
He steps back and vanishes, and Harper appears out of the dark, jaw clenched. Apparently he likes the Augurs as much as I do.
You can keep them out of your head, he says. The Nightbringer, too. I can show you how, if you like.
Fine, I say, already making for the palace. On the way to Navium. We soon reach the balcony of Livy's apartments, and I do not spot a single soldier. Avatas is stationed below, and I'm reminding myself to yell at Farris, who captains Livy's personal guard. When the air shifts, I'm not alone.
Peace, Shrike.
Farris Candolin steps out of the arched doorway that leads into Livy's quarters, his hands up, short blonde hair a mess.
She's waiting for you. You should have bleeding told her it was stupid to summon me. I don't tell the Empress what to do, Farris says. I just try to make sure no one hurts her while she's doing it.
Something about how he says it makes the hair on my neck rise, and in two steps I have a dagger at his throat.
Watch it with her, Farris, I say.
You flirt like your life depends on it, but if Marcus suspects she is disloyal, he will kill her, and the illustrian paters will believe he had every right to do it.
Don't worry about me, Farris says. I've got a lovely Makeda girl waiting for me in the Weaver's District. Most spectacular hips I've ever seen. Would have been there by now.
He glares at me until I release him.
But someone needed to be on duty.
Two people, I say. Who's your backup? A figure steps into the light from the shadows beside the door. A thrice broken nose, deep brown skin, and blue eyes that always sparkle, even beneath the silver mask.
Raelius? 10 hells, is that you?
Silvio Raelius salutes, before flashing a grin that made knees weak at illustrian parties across Serra for nearly all of my teenage years, including my knees, before I learned better. Elias and I hero-worshipped him, though he is only 2 years older. He was one of the few upper-classmen who wasn't a monster to the younger students.
Bloodshrike, he salutes. My sim is yours.
Words as pretty as that smile. I don't return his, and he realizes then that he's dealing with the Bloodshrike and not a young cadet from Blackcliff. Make them true. Protect her, or your life is forfeit. I slip past them both and into Livy's bedroom. As my eyes adjust, the floorboards near a tapestry creak. Cloth whispers as the contours of the room come into focus. Livy's bed is empty. On her side table, a cup of tea, wildwood from the scent of it, sits untouched. Livia pokes her head out from behind the tapestry and motions me forward. I can barely make her out, which means any spies within the walls can't see her either.
You should have drunk the tea. I am careful of her wounded hand. It must hurt.
Her clothes rustle, and a soft click sounds. Stale air and the smell of wet stone wash over me. A hallway stretches before us. We step in, and she closes the door, finally speaking.
An empress who bears her pain with fortitude is an empress who gains respect, she says. My women have spread the rumor that I scorn the tea, that I bear the pain without fear. But bleeding hells, it hurts.
The moment she says it, a familiar compulsion comes over me. The need to heal her, to sing her better.
I can help you, I say.
Bleeding skies, how will I explain it to her?
We don't have time, sister, she whispers. Come, this passage connects my rooms to his. I've used it before, but be silent. He cannot catch us.
We pad down the hallway toward a tiny crack of light. The muttering begins when we're halfway down. The light is a spy hole, big enough to admit sound, but too small to see through very clearly. I glimpse Marcus, bare of armor, stalking back and forth across his cavernous quarters.
You have to stop doing this when I'm in the throne room.
He digs his hands into his hair.
Do you want to have died just so I can get hurled off the throne for being insane?
Silence, then.
I won't bleeding touch her. I can't help that her sister's gagging for it.
I nearly choke, and Livy grips me.
I had my reasons. she whispers.
I will do what I must to keep this empire,
Marcus growls, and for the first time I see something, a pale shadow, like a face glimpsed in a mirror underwater. A second later, it's gone, and I shake myself. A trick of the light, perhaps.
If that means breaking a few fingers to keep your precious Bloodshrike in line, so be it. I wanted to break her arm.
10 hells, I breathe to Livia. He's barking. He's gone mad. He thinks what he's seeing is real. Livia shakes her head. Maybe it is. It doesn't matter. He cannot remain on the throne. At best, he's taking orders from a ghost. At worst, he's hallucinating. We have to support him, I say. The augurs named him emperor. If he's deposed or killed, we risk civil war, or the commandant swooping in and naming herself empress. Do we? Livy takes my hand with her good one and places it on her stomach. She doesn't speak. She doesn't have to.
Oh, you... That's why you and he... Oh.
Blackcliff prepared me for many things. It did not prepare me for my sister's pregnancy, by the man who slit the throats of our parents and sister.
This is our answer, Shrike. His heir, I whisper. A regency.
Bleeding skies. If Marcus disappears after the child is born, Livia and Jens Aquila would run the empire until the child came of age. We could train the boy up to be a true and just statesman. The illustrian Jens would accept it because the heir would be from a high-born house. The plebeians would accept it because he is Marcus's son and thus represents them too. But how do you know it's a boy? She turns her eyes, my eyes, our mother's eyes, to me, and I have never seen anyone look so sure of anything in my life.
It's a boy, Bloodshrike, she says. You must trust me. He already quickens. By the grain moon, if all is well, he will be here.
I shiver. The grain moon again.
When the commandant finds out, she'll come after you. I have to kill her.
Livia takes the words from my mouth.
Before she finds out.
When I ask Livia if Marcus knows of the pregnancy, she shakes her head.
I confirmed it only today, and I wanted to tell you first.
Tell him, Livy. I forget her title.
He wants an heir. Perhaps he won't.
I gesture to her hand.
But no one else. Hide it as best you can.
She puts a finger to my lips. Marcus's muttering has stopped.
Go, Shrike,
Livy breathes.
Mother, father, Hannah.
Suddenly I cannot breathe. He won't take Livy too. I'll die before I let it happen.
I'll fight him.
My sister digs her fingers into my shoulder. The pain focuses me.
You'll fight him.
She shoves me toward her room.
He'll die because he's no match for your anger. And in the frenzy to replace him, our enemies will have us both killed because we would have made it easy for them to do so. We must live. For him.
She touches her stomach.
For father and mother and Hannah.
For the Empire.
Go!
She shoves me out the door, just as light floods the passageway. I race through her room, past Faris and Raelius, flipping over the balcony to the rope tied below, cursing myself as Marcus shouts, as he lands the first blow, as the crack of another of my sister's bones echoes in my ears.
Part 2. Inferno. Chapter 11. Liar. 4 weeks later. Darren and I jostle through the sea of scholar refugees on the rutted dirt road into Edessa. 2 more tired bodies and dirty faces amid the hundreds seeking sanctuary in Marin's shining capital city. Silence hangs like a fog over the refugees as they plod onward. Most of these scholars were turned away from the other Mariner cities, All have seen homes lost, family and friends tortured or murdered, raped or imprisoned. The marshals wield their weapons of war with merciless efficiency. They want to break the scholars. And if I don't stop the Nightbringer, if I don't find this beekeeper in Edessa, they will. Shaver's prophecy haunts me. Darren and I discuss it obsessively, trying to make sense of each line. Bits of it, the sparrows, the butcher, dredge up old memories, scraps of thoughts that I cannot quite grasp hold of. We'll figure it out, Darren glances over, reading the furrow in my brow. We have bigger problems. Our shadow. The man appeared 3 days ago, trailing us as we left a small village, or at least that is when we first noticed him. Since then, he's remained far enough away that we cannot get a good look at him, but close enough that my blade feels fused to my palm. Every time I don my invisibility in the hopes of getting closer to him, he disappears. Still there, Darren chances a look behind us. Lurking, like a bleeding wraith. The circles beneath my brother's eyes make his irises look almost black. His cheekbones jut out, as they did when I first rescued him from Koth. Since our shadow appeared, Darren has slept little. But even before that, nightmares of Koth and the Warden plagued him. Sometimes I wish the Warden back to life, just so I could kill him myself. Strange how monsters can reach from beyond the grave, as potent in death as they were in life. We'll lose him at the city gates, I try to sound convincing, and lie low when we get in. Find a cheap inn to stay at where no one will look at us twice. And then, I add, we can ask around for the beekeeper. Under the guise of adjusting my hood, I glance back quickly at our shadow. He's close now, and beneath the scarf that hides his face, his red sickle mouth curves into a smile. A weapon flashes in his hand. I spin back around. We wind down from the foothills, and Edessa's gold-flecked wall comes into view, a marvel of white granite that glows orange under the fading, blood-streaked sky. Along the eastern wall, a mass of grey tents blooms out for nearly a mile. The scholar refugee camp. In the bay to the north, sea ice floats in fat chunks, its briny smell slicing through the dirt and grime of the road. Clouds sit low on the horizon, and an estival wind blows in from the south, scattering them. As they part, a near-collected gasp ripples through the travelers, for in the center of Edessa, a spire of stone and glass soars into the sky, pinioning the heavens. It twists like the horn of some mythical creature, impossibly balanced and glowing white. I have only ever heard it described, but the descriptions do it no justice. The Great Library of Edessa. An unwelcome memory surfaces. Red hair, brown eyes, and a mouth that lied, lied, lied. Keenan, the Nightbringer, telling me that he too wanted to see the Great Library.
She tasted sweet, boy, like dew and a clear dawn.
My skin crawls thinking of the filth he spat in the waiting place. Look, I nod to the throngs gathered outside the city gates, pushing to enter before they close at nightfall. We can lose him there, especially if I disappear. When we are closer to the city, I drop in front of Darren, as if adjusting a bootlace. Then I pull on my invisibility. I'm right next to you, I whisper when I stand. And Darren nods, weaving quickly now through the crowd, using his sharp elbows to muscle forward. The closer we get to the gate, the slower it goes. Finally, as the sun dips into the west, we stand before the massive wooden entrance, carved with whales and eels, octopuses and mermaids. Beyond, a cobbled street curves up and disappears into a warren of brightly painted buildings, lamps winking in their windows. I think of my mother, who came to Odessa when she was only a few years older than me. Did it look the same? Did she share the awe I feel now?
Your guarantor, sir.
One of the dozens of mariner guards fixes his attention on Darren, and despite the seething crowds, he is coolly polite. Darren shakes his head in confusion.
My guarantor? Who are you staying with in the city? What family or guild?
We're staying at an inn, Darren says.
We can pay. Gold can be stolen. I require names. The inn where you plan to procure rooms and your guarantor. Who can vouch for your quality? Once you provide names, you will wait in a holding area while your information is verified. After which, you may enter Odessa.
Darren looks uncertain. We do not know anyone in Odessa. Since leaving Elias, we have tried several times to get in touch with Araj, the Skirite leader, who escaped Koff with us, but have heard nothing back from him. Darren nods at the soldier's explanation, as if we have any idea what we will do instead.
And if I don't have a guarantor, you'll find the entrance to the Scholar refugee camp east of here.
The soldier, who until now had kept his attention on the pressing crowd behind us, finally looks at Darren. The man's eyes narrow.
Say.
Time to go, I hiss to my brother, and he mumbles something to the soldier before quickly shoving back into the crowd.
He can't have known my face, Darren says. I've never met him before.
Maybe all scholars look alike to him, I say, but the explanation rings hollow to me. More than once, we turn to see if the soldier follows. I slow down only when I spot him at the gate, speaking with another group of scholars. Our shadow also appears to have lost us, and we head east, making our way to one of a dozen long lines that lead into the refugee camp. Nan told me stories of what Mother did when she led the Northern Resistance here in Odessa, more than 25 years ago. The Mariner King, Ermond, worked with her to protect the scholars, to give them work and homes and a permanent place in Mariner society. Things have clearly gone to pot since then. Even from outside the boundaries of the camp, its gloom is pervasive. Bands of children wander through the tents ahead, most far too young to be left unaccompanied. A few dogs slink through the muddy roadways, occasionally sniffing at the open sewers. Why is it always us? All of these people, so many children, hunted and abused and tormented, families stolen, lives shattered. They come all this way to be rejected yet again, sent outside the city walls to sleep in flimsy tents, to fight over paltry scraps of food, to starve and freeze and suffer more. And we are expected to be thankful, to be happy. So many are. I know it. Happy to be safe, to be alive. But it's not enough. Not to me. As we get closer to the entrance, the camp comes into clearer view. White parchment flutters from the cloth walls. I squint at it, but it's not until we're nearing the front of the line that I finally make out what's on it. My own face. Darren's, staring out sullenly beneath damning words. By personal decree of King Ermond of Marin, wanted, Lyre and Darren of Serra, for incitement of rebellion, agitation, and conspiring against the crown. Reward, 10,000 marks. It looks like the posters from the Commandant's office at Blackcliff, like the one from Ner, when the Blood Shrike was hunting Elias and me and offering a massive reward. What in the skies, I whisper, did we do to King Ermond, to offend him so? Could the marshals be behind it?
They don't bleeding know we're here.
They have spies just like everyone else, I say. Look back, Like you see someone you recognize, and then walk. A commotion at the back of the line ripples toward us as a squad of mariner troops marches toward the camp from Edessa. Darin hunches down, taking refuge deeper in his hood. Shouts ring out ahead of us, and light flares sharply, followed quickly by a plume of black smoke. Fire. The shouts quickly turn to cries of rage and fear. My mind seizes. My thoughts go to Sarah, to the night the soldiers took Darin. The pounding at our door and the silver of the mask's face. Nan's and Pop's blood on the floor. And Darin screaming at me. Liar! Run! Voices around me rise in terror. Scholars in the camp flee. Groups of children cluster, making themselves small, hoping they are not noticed. Blue and gold-clad mariner soldiers weave through the tents, tearing them apart as they search for something. No. Someone. The scholars around us scatter, running every which way, driven by a fear that's been hammered into our bones. Always us. Our dignity shredded, our families annihilated, our children torn from their parents. Our blood soaking the dirt. What sin was so great that scholars must pay with every generation, with the only thing we have left? Our lives. Darin, calm just a moment ago, is motionless beside me, looking as terror-stricken as I feel. I grab his hand. I cannot fall apart now. Not when he needs me to hold it together. Let's go. I pull him away, but there are soldiers herding those in the lines back toward the camp. Close by, I spy a dark space between two refugee tents. Quick, Darin! A voice cries out behind us. They're not here! A scholar woman, who is naught but skin and bones, tries to shake off a mariner soldier. I've told you! We know you're sheltering them! The mariner, who speaks, is taller than me by a few inches, her scaled silver armor tight against the powerful muscles of her shoulders. Her chiseled brown face lacks the cruelty of a mask, but she is nearly as intimidating. She tears a poster off the side of one of the tents, where it's been pinned. Turn over Lyra and Darin or Sarah, and we will leave you be. Otherwise, we will raise this camp and scatter its refugees to the four winds. We are generous, true. That does not make us fools. Beyond the soldier, dozens of scholar children are being herded toward a makeshift holding pen. A cloud of embers explodes into the sky as, behind them, two more tents go up in flames. I shudder at the way the fire growls and vaunts, as if it is celebrating the screams rising from my people. It's the prophecy, Darin whispers. Do you remember? The sparrows will drown. And none will know it. The scholars must be the sparrows, Lyra. The mariners have always been called the sea people. They are the flood. We cannot let it happen, I make myself say the words. They're suffering because of us. This is the only home they have, and we're taking it away from them. Darin immediately understands my intent. He shakes his head, taking a step back, movements jerky and panicked. No. He says. We can't. How are we supposed to find the beekeeper if we're in prison? Or dead? How are we supposed to? His voice chokes off, and he shakes his head again and again. I know they will lock us up. I grab him, shake him. I need to break through his terror. I need him to believe me. But I swear to the skies that I will get us out. We cannot let the camp burn, Darin. It's wrong. The mariners want us. And we're right here. A scream erupts from behind us. A scholar man claws at a mariner guard, howling as she removes a child from his grasp. Don't hurt her, he begs. Please, please. Darin watches, shuddering. You're right. He fights to get the words out, and I am relieved and proud and broken-hearted because I feel sick at the thought of watching my brother dragged back to a prison. I'll have no one else die for me, especially not you. I'll turn myself in. You'll be safe. Not a chance, I say. Never again. Where you go, I go. I drop my invisibility, and vertigo nearly levels me. My sight darkens to a dank room with a light-haired woman within. I cannot see her face. Who is she? When my vision clears, only a few seconds have passed. I shake the strange images away and leave the shelter of the tents. The mariner soldier's instinct is excellent, for though we are a good 30 feet from her, the moment we step into the light, her head swivels toward us. The plume and angled eye holes of her helmet make her look like an angry hawk, but her hand is light on her sim as she watches our approach. Laya and Darin of Sera. She doesn't sound surprised, and I know then that she expected to find us here, that she knew we had arrived in Edessa. You are under arrest for conspiracy to commit crimes against the kingdom of Marin. You will come with me.
Chapter 12. Elias. Though the sun hasn't yet set, the tribal encampment is quiet when I approach. The cook fires are doused, the horses sheltered beneath a canvas tarp. The red and yellow painted wagons are sealed tight against the driving late spring rain. One lamplight flickers within. I move slowly, though not out of wariness. My Arthur tugs at me, and it requires all my strength to ignore that summons. A few hundred yards west of the caravan, the Duskan Sea breaks against the rocky shore, its roar nearly drowning out the mournful cries of white-headed gulls above. But my mask's instincts are as sharp as ever, and I sense the approach of the Kahani of Tribe Nasur long before she appears, along with the 6 Nasur tribesmen guarding her.
Elias Vittorius.
The Kahani's silver dreadlocks hang to her waist, and I can clearly make out the elaborate storyteller's tattoos on her dark brown skin.
You are late.
I am sorry, Kahani. I don't bother giving her an excuse. Kahanis are as skilled at trapping lies as they are at telling stories. I beg your forgiveness.
Bah! She sniffs. You begged to meet with me, too. I do not know why I consented. Marshals took my brother's son a week ago, after they raided our grain stores. My respect for Memirila is all that keeps me from gutting you like a pig, boy.
I'd like to see you try. Have you heard from Mamie?
She is well hidden, and recovering from the horrors your ilk inflicted upon her. If you think I will tell you where she is, you are a bigger fool than I suspected. Come.
She jerks her head toward the caravan, and I follow. I understand her rage. The marshal's war on the tribes is evident in every burned-out wagon littering the countryside, every ululating wail rising from tribal villages as families mourn those taken. The Kahani moves quickly, and as I trail her, my Arthur's pull grows stronger, a physical wrench that makes me want to sprint back to the waiting place, 3 leagues distant. A sense of wrongness steals over me, as if I've forgotten something important. But I can't tell if it is my own instinct prickling, or if my Arthur is manipulating my mind. More than once in the past few weeks, I've felt someone, or something, flitting at the edges of the waiting place, entering and then leaving, as if trying to gauge a reaction. Every time I've felt it, I've windwalked to the border, and every time I've found nothing. The rain has at least silenced the djinn. Those fiery bastards hate it. But the ghosts are troubled, forced to remain in the waiting place longer than they should, because I cannot pass them through fast enough. Shaver's warning haunts me.
If you do not pass the ghosts through, it will mean your failure as soul catcher, and the end of the human world as you understand it.
Martha pulls at me again, but I make myself ignore it. The Kahani and I weave our way through the wagons of the caravan until we reach one that sits apart from the rest. Its black draping and sharp contrast